Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He has a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And what is the inside scoop then on what just happened in Somalia just before the President's State of the Union address? Apparently, he was informed that a Danish and American hostage were rescued by the same SEAL Team 6 that killed Osama bin Laden. What do you know about what happened?
Two things. One is there's no such thing as SEAL Team 6. It's called DEVGRU, and it's actually a unit called the Joint Special Operations Command Horn of Africa, or CJTF HOA, which is based in Camp Lemanye. And it's made out of Air Force, Marine, foreign elements, Navy SEALs, and a variety of special operations folks. But they like to promote that myth of SEAL Team 6 being everywhere. The second thing is you just saw for the first time since 1993 the overt presence of American boots on the ground. And if you remember Black Hawk Down and the controversy surrounding that incident, we've always had this sort of unwritten rule that you can't put American boots on the ground. So you just saw a very public view that, yes, we can, and we can get away with it. So you'll see a change, I think, in more operations, because there's another American that was kidnapped 3 days ago, and over 150 foreigners in the maritime and other kidnap victims. So things will change.
So just to touch on the American journalist who was kidnapped on Friday, who is this journalist? Do you know?
Yeah, well, Michael Scott Moore is actually from Manhattan Beach, California. He lives in Berlin now. He writes for Der Spiegel, and he also writes for The Atlantic, although Der Spiegel is trying to shut down coverage of his kidnap. He was over there doing a story, a book about pirates, and following up on an interview he had done and published in Der Spiegel about building a new port in Habio, which is a pirate center. He went out to meet someone at the airport and was kidnapped by two men in two SUVs, Toyota Surfs, and then taken down to Habio, where the elders argued with his kidnappers, and then moved out of town, and he's now being held.
So the people that were just rescued, an American aid worker, Jessica Buchanan, and a Danish D-miner, Paul Thisted, they were captured back in October. Weren't they captured also by, or wasn't there some complicity with their driver?
Exact same road, exact same techniques. What happened is that these two folks work for Danish Refugee Council. They were doing a seminar on UXO and demining. They went into town. They were on their way home. They were actually stopped on the way to the airport and essentially kidnapped by their own guard. That guard were arrested, and then they magically disappeared out of jail. They've been moved around. They've been put on ships. They've been moved here and there by elders who are very angry at the pirates holding them. But the good thing is that pirates have just recently started moving towards land-based kidnapping, and they're not that smart about using cell phones. They're not that smart about what predators can do. So the Americans have a lot of assets in the region in the air, so they were able to track the pirates' movements, get a visual on the two victims, and then launch this raid.
So you're suggesting that because I take it a beefed-up naval presence in the waters around Somalia, that the pirates are moving to land-based kidnapping as opposed to capturing ships?
Right. Well, this is the kidnapping 101. Since about 2005, the pirates have been complicit with insurance companies where if they know that they can grab a ship and not damage the cargo or the crew, they know that they'll be able to negotiate a fairly sizable ransom. Those ransoms run about $4.5 million on average. But the unwritten rule is you can't damage the cargo or the ship. You can't harm the hostages. Well, what happened is that these maritime companies began putting private security guards, which Hillary Clinton actually promoted, on these ships, which has stopped and reduced the number of hijackings to almost less than one a month. So So now these pirates are desperate for cash, and then they decided to go after the NGOs and the journalists and the few foreigners that are in town. They even bought two Spanish MSF workers from Al-Shabaab for $250,000, and they want to turn that into a profit. But here's the problem. That when they used to hold 20 to 30 crew on a ship, nobody ever came after them because they knew that typically a UK-based insurance company would pay them money, so there was no rescue attempts. Now you've got people that don't have insurance. There is no sort of standard procedure, and you've got governments that are sort of sick and tired of this constant criminality, and they're literally, you know, 15 minutes away. So that's why the pirates are learning the hard way that land-based kidnapping is not a good idea.
And the MSF, that's the Médecins Sans Frontières, who are they holding there?
There were two Spanish ladies that were working.
They're doctors, right?
Correct. They were working in Dadaab refugee camp, which is right on the border of Kenya and Somalia in the south. And Al-Shabaab had created a plan to destroy tourism in Kenya and also to disrupt aid and relief workers. And they began to put this plan into play, but what happened was that one of their leaders got killed and they got scared. So they managed to kidnap Judith Tebbit. They shot her husband. She was on vacation at a coastal resort near Lamu. They kidnapped this poor elderly French woman who was in a wheelchair. Unfortunately, she died while in captivity. They grabbed these two MSF gals, and they had sort of an open order for any foreigners. They ended up flipping these victims to a pirate called Afweni, who works out of Harder in the central part of Somalia. So right now, in addition to the maritime people, which is over 100 sailors, you've also got about 20 land-based hostages, mostly around the central part of what they call Galmudug, the central part of Somalia.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who is the founder and publisher of Somalia Report. We're talking about the rescue of the American and the Danish hostages by a U.S. Special Forces team and the broader issue of piracy. Now, in Somalia, which of course is a totally failed state with an African Union force in the north and chaos in the south, where Al-Shabaab, the allegedly Al-Qaeda-related organization, operates. In this case, it's criminality and not Al-Shabaab, which has some political veneer to it.
Correct.
But you just told me that the Al-Shabaab grabbed a couple of hostages, Western hostages, and then sold them to a pirate?
Yeah, they needed the money. This was not something they planned, and Al-Shabaab does not communicate or typically do business with pirates because pirates know that that would then unleash all the anti-terrorism forces on them. And Al-Shabaab does not get involved in piracy because they think it's a criminal act. So what happened was you had one group of Al-Shabaab who needed the cash because they were being attacked by the Kenyans and they were under pressure. So they made a quick payment, about $450,000, by selling the two MSF gals to a pirate.
But who's still holding them, right?
Yes, they're still being kidnapped. The interesting thing is that there's only two countries that have assets in the region, and that's the French and the Americans, and they both operate out of Camp Lamanye. This is in Djibouti, yes. It's a little tiny country in the straits there. And that's about it. So even the naval forces really can't deal with pirates. If you remember, four Americans were killed when the USS Enterprise and the Stennis got involved in trying to prevent a hijacking, and it freaked the pirates out, and they ended up killing their hostages before the special operations team got there.
So this base that they have, Camp Lamanye in Djibouti, this tiny little country in the Gulf there of Aden, I guess it's called.
Mm-hmm.
It has about 2,500 permanent Marines based there, and they have
They have an overt and covert capability there. So they have an overt stationing of aviation support and Marines, and they've got a covert collection of anti-terrorism people. And just by coincidence, one of the special forces guys I was with worked out of there. And it's a wide mix of special operations people from various countries, and they get together and they go out, typically in Yemen. Their task was really going after Al-Qaeda in Yemen and also northern Kenya. So they use that as a base to launch deep strikes. And so between Nairobi, a tiny base up in Lamu, and then some just very minor support on the ground in Somalia, they can kind of reach out, do predator strikes, do snatch and grabs, things like that.
But you mentioned earlier, Robert Young-Pelton, that the team, the same team that killed bin Laden, that apparently rescued this American aid worker, Jessica Buchanan, and the Danish D-miner, that they were picked up by a predator drone. So I take it that predator drones also operate out of this area, right?
Yeah, well, the drones operate out of Ethiopia along the border there. There's a program there. You get a cluster of three drones to keep them up in the air for 24 hours. There's also a grouping in the Seychelles, and then they also have a drone program in Camp Lamagne. So they're basically in the south, though. They're really looking for Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab-related targets. In the north, they're not worried about piracy so much, but they do track some of the movements because Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have been sailing north from the south into the northern part of Somalia and back into Yemen because there's a safe haven for them on the coast of Yemen. So they cover that region, but there aren't that many people.
So what's happening with this surrogate war or this quiet war that's going on against Al-Shabaab, where the U.S. is essentially paying the Kenyans and the Ugandans, aren't they, to do the boots on the ground?
Well, the UN force is called AMISOM. They started off in Mogadishu, and it was primarily Ugandans in very entrenched positions, but they've had some success. So the Kenyans did a little fast trick. They actually invaded and then convinced the U.S. to actually pay them to invade, so they became part of AMISOM. Ethiopia has the top border under control, but they don't want to be part of AMISOM, if you remember what happened in 2006 and 2007.
Well, that was when George Bush sent the Ethiopians in, right?
Yeah, and that's when they created Al-Shabaab, because the people rebelled against the Christian Ethiopians.
That was a minor blunder, but apropos, or in the spirit of, if you will, Iraq, right?
Yeah, that, you know, you can win and lose at the same time. So they won by kicking out the Islamic courts, but they ended up creating a much different problem, which was cementing Al-Qaeda with this group called Al-Shabaab, which is who is fighting in Kenya and also Somalia. So the war has been spread by the Kenyans going in to Somalia. There are now terrorist threats inside Kenya, and actually a new Al-Qaeda leader who has threatened to start a war inside Kenya. So once again, you can win militarily, but you can lose on the security angle.
So you mentioned earlier, Robert Young-Pelton, again, the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, that this raid that just took place just as the State of the Union began, you know, the president apparently signaled to the Secretary of Defense as he was being applauded in the Congress, you know, good job. Mm-hmm. So I guess they were just getting the word right at that moment.
Well, there's a political slant to it, because we've been following these people from the day they were kidnapped, and we know their location and who's holding them, and we talk to their kidnappers. So it's rather unusual that President Obama would just happened to greenlight this raid on the same day he was doing a State of the Union speech, and also try to tie it into the same group, SEAL Team 6. So there's no proof that SEAL Team 6 was involved in this, because there's no such group as SEAL Team 6. They work with the folks in Lamagne, but you can see a little Hollywood script forming here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of, he bookended his State of the Union with praise of the military. So tell me, though, when you said that after there's been this aversion to getting boots on the grounds in Somalia since Black Hawk Down, which happened under Clinton, who inherited the
Bush's
intervention,
right,
which was a humanitarian intervention that turned into a military intervention, what evidence is there that there's a sea change here, that now the U.S. is more prepared to put boots on the ground in this totally failed state?
Well, what happened was that they were doing a hands-off approach, and you had actually Libya funding most of the Somali government activities. It was based on, you know, if you show us some results, we'll give you some money. So what happened is Uganda got very aggressive. They had 12,000 people there. They actually were able to push Al-Shabaab out. Kenya saw the opportunity. They had planned this thing with the U.S. for over 2 years, and the U.S. wasn't that thrilled about the idea of Kenya invading, because they've never actually fought a war before, and they only have 5 jets. And Ethiopia had been warned against interceding. And essentially what happened is that these local actors said, look, we're not going to tolerate this anymore, you know, incursions, kidnappings, terrorism. So Kenya made its move. The U.S. tacitly approved it, even though they said publicly they had no idea that Kenya was invading Somalia. Ethiopia magically charged all the way into the northern part, and suddenly money's flowing, and they're increasing the size of the peacekeeping force and even changing their mission. And al-Shabaab is on the run. Al-Shabaab is being damaged by the larger military presence inside Somalia. So it's actually all good news when you compare it to the old way things were. But, you know, it's another Libya. We are essentially, you know, bankrolling someone to go in and start a war and try to keep our fingerprints off it.
Well, it also sounds like a kind of sovereign version of Halliburton, isn't it, where you actually hire the armies of sovereign countries?
Well, we learned our lesson. So, yes, there are some contractors working inside Somalia, which I do an in-depth review on the site, but it's easier to pay poor African countries because we only pay about $1,200 per month per troop. The government pockets about half of that, so Uganda, Kenya, I think Djibouti's got some troops in there, and they're going to send some troops from Sierra Leone, and, you know, it's sort of a pylon. That money goes into the government's pockets. They get new guns, they get new uniforms, they get all kinds of goodies. And we're essentially providing this sort of military aid through the back door. The training's all done by U.S. Special Forces back in their home territory. So it's a proxy war, but through sovereign states.
And it's a lot cheaper than hiring Eric Prince at Blackwater, right? Or
well, it's a lot cheaper than the political risk involved of having American troops there. There are contractors working there, and they do have money. You know, the CIA pays contractors to train up local troops inside the country. But I think, you know, under the Obama administration, they're very concerned about political risk. They don't want to see another Fallujah or Black Hawk Down where Americans are chopped up and hanging from light poles. So I think they've made that decision that there will be no Americans visually on the ground. And that's why you see these proxy forces.
Well, just in closing, what's the latest on the ex-CIA guy that's running Puntland along with the former UN human rights guy, Pierre Prosper? Have they managed to sort of carve out a little kind of peaceful island there in the middle of this war-torn country?
Yeah, Somaliland is probably the most peaceful region, and they broke away back in the 90s. And then Puntland didn't break away entirely, but their major trading partner is the UAE, and the UAE paid for a very large anti-piracy training program, and that's actually happening right now as we speak. I think there were a number of people linked into it because they thought it was a good idea, and the State Department and other people in Nairobi said, well, we don't think that's a good idea. So there was a lot of bad publicity, but I've actually been up there and seen the camp and seen the recruits. It's the only indigenous anti-piracy activity going on in Somalia. So it's showing that everybody is basically tired of waiting around for Uncle Sam to write them a check direct, and they've done these things on their own, and all of a sudden the money flows behind it. So Puntland is doing well, although a lot of al-Shabaab are moving up into Puntland, and the same with Somaliland. But these nations seem to do better on their own than without us babysitting them and steering them.
But, you know, pirates don't sort of, you know, watch a Johnny Depp movie and decide overnight to become a pirate. Aren't they pirates out of desperation? They've lost their fishing grounds. They have no money.
No, that's a myth. It's a very funny myth, because I spent a lot of time talking to pirates and visiting with them. What happened was in 2000, a security company named Hart trained up a maritime defense force and taught the same guys who fought in Black Hawk Down, the Habagadir, how to board a ship, how to look at the manifest, how to call the owner, how to fine, you know, take the ship under control, take it back to port, and collect a fine. That project fell apart in 2000, sort of late 2000, and this same Marine force and the same sort of anti-piracy force said, hey, you know, instead of making $50 a month, why don't we just grab ships on our own? That was the nucleus of the modern pirates we see today, because they knew about the insurance payments and not harming the crew or the cargo to get paid. But those guys, the big three, have all been retired or put in jail. So the new crew are the ones that are doing the land-based hijacking, and their lifespans are going to be fairly short. So it evolves every month.
But did you say that we
trained up these people to become pirates?
Well, I don't say we. Not you and me. I mean, Hearts is a British company.
What was their motive?
Well, it was a very good motive. It was to restart the fishing industry because the tuna that go by the coast of Somalia can reach, you know, between $5,000 and $10,000 if they're frozen and shipped off to Japan. Right now, you can buy an entire tuna for $2, bluefin tuna. So their idea was to stop the poachers, you know, the large fishing fleets that go in there and steal all the fish from Spain and China.
Taiwan, right.
Exactly, and kick them out and then keep that money inside the country. But the country fell apart, so...
Oh, I see.
So those people who had jobs suddenly didn't have jobs and thought coast guarding was akin to piracy. So that's how it started.
Well, I thank you so much for filling us in on this country that is in the news, but not in the way that you've explained. So I recommend people go to your site, somaliareport.com.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about President Obama's new financial police force.